It's time for the only show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug Gefeller. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for being with us.
Tried to crank up the music a little bit for you. We played a little different version today.
I liked it a lot. I'm not too sure about the gravel voice guy you had before, but hey. Well, look, welcome to today's episode of The Coaching Perspective, and our topic for today is selecting the best business model for you. And we're going to use the startup of a coaching practice as an example and look at some of the key steps that you need to take when you start that business or really any business. But first, if you're listening to our podcast, then thank you for visiting our website, thecoachingperspective.com. And be sure to check out our archives for other shows with some great guests. And speaking of guests, if you'd like to be in the show, we're always looking for coaches, CEOs, HR professionals to interview, anybody with a good story. Just send me an email, doug@thecoachingperspective.com. Well, last week's show, Using Job Descriptions as a Coaching Tool, has now been posted to our website. Listen to the podcast, and I'll take you through how I turn this old standby, job descriptions, into a key element of the onboarding of new employees and also as a cornerstone for management transition programs. Well, let's get right on to today's show. You know, as we said at the start of the show, our topic for today is selecting the best business model for you. And we're going to use a coaching practice as an example and look at some of the key steps as you go through it. You know, it's so easy to get passionate about working on our products or services, but what about all the other things that need to be done to make a business run well on a daily basis? We're going to go over my checklist for startups. Now, you know, this is a topic that has been with me on many coaching calls with many clients. And it starts out in all kinds of different ways. And it hit me recently, and I decided to talk about it today because of a conversation I was having with a client. And as I was getting ready for that coaching call, I was reviewing my notes and looking at them and thinking that, there aren't a lot of things getting done. We keep looking at things to do, or the client keeps identifying things they're going to do, and I don't hear about those things being completed. I maybe need to push a little harder here. Well, when I got on the call with the client, the first thing the client says to me is, you know, I need to talk today about procrastination. I'm just not getting things done. I'm going, whoa, that's kind of weird. I was going to sort of get around to that topic in a sensitive way, but here it is, throwing right out at me. And as we started to talk about that, you know, there's lots of places we could go. We could go with, are you having a problem with time management? Are you not organized? Are you not making a good list? Do you have trouble setting priorities? You know, there's lots of ways we could go about that. But somehow I just sort of had the intuitive call to say, you know, is the things that you're talking about doing all relate to not coaching somebody, but running your business, specifically starting a relatively new coaching business and getting more clients? And would you say there's any truth to the fact that the reason you have difficulty getting to these things is because you don't like to do them? And there was this silence on the other end of the line. And the client came back and said, you know, you're right. I don't like doing any of those things. And so that's kind of how I decided to talk about today's topic. So many of us, so many people get into a business because they love what that business is, whether it's being a coach, I love coaching people, or whether it's I love being an architect because I like to draw buildings, or an engineer or an accountant because I like to play with numbers, whatever it is, you name it, they get into the business because of the product or service that they enjoy dealing with. And then no sooner do they get into that business and get going, and they are faced with all of these other things that are going to take a lot of their time that have to do with creating and running a business. Nothing to do with practicing your trade, but have to do with running a business that are common to all businesses. Somebody's got to open the doors. Somebody's got to turn on the lights. Somebody's got to send out the bills, you know, and it goes on and on with this long list of things that we have to do to stay in business. And so, you know, I thought we should kind of look at that and sort of take it through the program. And especially in coaching, you know, I have met so many wonderful, intuitive, sensitive coaches who came to coaching because they had a coaching experience and they thought, this is my calling. This is what I want to do. And they threw themselves into it and they went and got some training or they went and got credentialed. And then no sooner did they get out of their credentialing program and they go, how do I get clients? That's too hard. I don't like doing that. Is there another way to do that? And they go on this great quest, you know, sort of looking for the holy grail of finding clients. Isn't there an easier way somewhere that someone's not telling me about? So what would happen if before you even started the business, you started to ask yourself some of the questions that we're going to talk about today? First is, do you want to be an owner or do you want to be an employee? You know, just because, in this case, we're going to use coaching, just because we like to coach doesn't mean we like to run a business. And too often we just don't give enough thought as to what's required. And when we get into it, we find we don't like doing those things. So maybe we don't like the idea of being an employee either, but the world is never perfect. It's always many times a matter of choosing the lesser of two evils. So would the burden of working for somebody else be less than the burden of having to do all these things about running a business? If I worked for somebody else, could I show up and spend 8 hours coaching? Whereas if I worked for myself, would I have to spend 4 hours running the business, whatever that means, and only get to coach for four? So this is really a cornerstone question that needs to be asked. Do I really want to have my own business, or do I want to be an employee? And I don't think you can answer that question. I put it first, but really I think you have to go through the rest of the questions and then come back and look at it again. So let's assume that you're going to have your own business. Do you want to be the sole owner, or do you want to have partners? You know, you don't have to do everything yourself, and not all partnerships are bad. I mean, we hear horror stories about partnerships the same way you hear terrible stories about any other product you research on the internet. It seems like it's only the people that are unhappy with something are the ones that are vocal. All of the happy people don't say anything. And I think a lot of that has to do with partnerships. We don't hear about the successful, wonderful partnerships that have been going for years. We just hear about the problem ones. You know, and many of the most successful businesses are where two people with, different talents combine to create a really strong business proposition. So how do you, if you're going to think about a partner, what does that mean? How would I choose a partner? Well, we've talked about that on other shows, and you can go to the archive and look that up. But just briefly, you know, some of the things are, when does the partner have the same goals for the business as you do? Does the partner have the same goals for themselves in the business as you do? In other words, one partner gets in the business with the idea that my goal is to help people that are not able to pay, that want coaching and can't pay for it. And the other partner is in the business because I need more money to live off of. So how does spending our time coaching people who can't pay meet that goal? So you need to get that clear. The other is, how long do you want to be in business? One partner says, I want to be in business for the next 10 years. And the other partner says, You know, I have a short attention span. I think this is a great gig for 3 years, and then I want out. So, you know, you need to look at that as, are you in sync there? And if you're going to get out, what is the exit strategy for either one of you to get out? Or what is the exit strategy for the two of you to get out? And what would trigger that exit strategy? You know, we talk too often about succession plans and in business, and really you have to back up and go, why do we need a succession plan? Really, one of the major reasons is if you're changing the ownership of a business, if we're talking a smaller business where the owners are the key rainmakers, the key individuals in the business, and they're going to get out, who's going to take it over? You know, they may have been running it successfully for 20, 30 years, 10 years, whatever it is, by doing all this stuff themselves. And the day they decide, hey, I don't want to come to work every day, they turn around and look and go, I never hired anybody qualified to run the business. I just hired people qualified to practice our tradecraft, whatever that might be. So you need to look at the exit strategy for the partners. You need to look at, you know, if you're going to create a business, is the business going to have a life after you? Is it going to have a life after you and your partner? Is this a legacy business? You know, is this a business that you want to go on afterwards? You want to have your name up there in lights forever, or you want to provide employment for the people you've hired forever? But the other partner may be looking at it and going, you know, the day we make the first $1 million free and clear, I'm closing the door and walking away, and the heck with everybody. So nothing wrong with either one of those propositions, but there is a need to get in sync and identify what you want to do. Let me talk about one of the big decisions to make in coaching, and I'm going to call it the issue of direct sales or using a distributor. And that seems like a strange language. You know, in my work with manufacturing companies, we talk about using distributors to sell our product. I mean, we may not have a sales force. Instead, we've got distributors we've hired that they carry our line of products or services along with other people's services or products that are compatible with ours. And they go out and make calls with this large bushel basket full of multiple offerings now, and it's more efficient for them to call on a client than it would be for me with just one thing to sell. So, but in coaching, we don't think of it that way too often. Now, the closest I've come to it is companies that are providing services that are in some way complementary to coaching, or can use coaching to help them sell their primary service. The one that comes to my mind right off the bat is firms that are involved in either helping you find people or firms that are involved in transition. So if I've got a large company and I'm getting ready to lay off people, I bring in my my HR firm, I bring in my headhunting firm, and I go, you know, look, I'm going to need to lay these people off, and what kind of program can you put together so that I can lay them off and they'll be able to find another job? And that may be you give them some help in finding a job, you give them some help in writing a resume, you give them some office space to hotel in so that they're not here in my office because we want them out, or maybe you're going to provide them with some coaching to help them identify what they want to do and where they should go next. So for coaches, that is using a distributor. I don't have to go out and do the selling. I've got one of these other companies, whether it be a CPA firm, a headhunting firm, a legal firm, an HR firm, somebody who's already got a client, providing them a service, and they would like to offer my coaching services as an adjunct to what they're already doing, but they don't want to get into the coaching business. So they become a distributor for me. They sell my services. And as part of that deal, they take a piece of the action and I get a piece of the action. And that can, you know, we're not going to get into the details there, There's all kinds of ways to cut that. But it is a way for somebody who doesn't want to sell to solve the problem. Or maybe you're going to get into direct sales, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, where you're going to be selling your coaching services direct. Again, you know, the issue here in some ways is, what kind of model can you think of? How can you structure your business to avoid the things that you don't like or are not good at, so that you can focus and concentrate on the things that you do like and that you are good at? Now, to do that, you need to do a little survey on yourself. What is it that I'm good at? What is it that I like to do? And what is it that I do not like to do or I'm not good at? And there's all sorts of shades of gray in there. You know, so, you know, just as a personal example, I love to coach people. I love to speak to groups. I don't mind doing the accounting, because in a previous life I was an accountant, so I had a financial background. So I don't mind doing the accounting, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. When it comes to sales, I don't like doing the sales. I'm fascinated with computers, but I don't want to take the time to learn WordPress and to be able to do all the things that are needed to really maintain my own website and make it jump up and down and do the latest things. So I start to identify things I really like to do that are usually things I'm good at, things that I absolutely hate doing, which are usually things I'm bad at, and things that are someplace in the middle, which are things that I don't mind doing them as long as I don't have to spend too much time on it. So once I've kind of identified those things, then I can start to look. Let's go back. Do I have a partner? Does the partner have talents and abilities that are the opposite of mine? You know, most partnerships with two people who are alike with the same skill set have a sort of difficult time surviving because they're interchangeable. The strongest partnerships I've seen is where the two partners have different strengths. So one partner is a great business development kind of person, likes to go out, meet people, make contacts, close deals, negotiate the contracts, whatever. And that's the rainmaker. You know, you see a lot of that in let's say, legal firms. And the other partner in the firm is the one who wants to sit back in the office and go through the law library and do the research and prepare the case and go to court if you have to go to court and file all of the documents that are necessary, anything to avoid going out and having to go to lunches and dinners and business meetings and association groups and all of those things. So two partners with two different skill sets all of a sudden start to provide a very good, strong offering for the business. Now, what do you do if you don't really have that kind of, what if you do if you don't have a partner? Or if you and your partner don't have the skills that are necessary, well, you can start to look at the fact, am I just going to gut it out and spend more time doing the things I don't want to do and less time doing what I want to do, coaching people? Or am I going to hire some people? You know, today we have a lot of choices when we talk about hiring people. In the past, if I hired somebody, and I can think not too long ago, some 20-some years ago when I first started a business that I operated from the house doing executive forums, and I thought about hiring somebody, and the question was, well, I'm working out of the house. If I hire an employee, they're going to come to my house, and they're going to work in the house. I don't know if I like that. I'm not sure my wife likes it at all. In fact, she was real clear about not liking it. So, but today, we're in a different environment. Today, I can hire an employee that works for me that never shows up at my house, that never shows up at any office, that is a virtual employee, that may not even be in the same state. So when you look at the opportunity to hire employees, to not have to do all of this work yourself, you have lots of other choices. But before you go down the road of choosing somebody, Let's go back to our last radio broadcast that talked about job descriptions. If you don't have a very clear description of what you want the person to do, how can you expect them to know what you want? So you first identify, what is the ideal person going to do? What is it I would expect them to be able to do day one without any training? And then how long would I expect, would I be willing to give them to learn all the things they need to know to be able to totally fill the job the way I've designed it? And that starts to help you identify also whether you are looking at a virtual employee or whether you're looking at somebody that's got to be sitting alongside of you. We kind of touched on it. We talked about, where's your business going to be located? Is it going to be in an office or a home business? You know, it's so easy these days with the internet and the low cost of computers and printers and all the other electronics to just work out of the house and not pay any rent. Well, not any more rent than you're already paying to live in your house. But, you know, you can present yourself in a very professional way where people don't even know where you're working out of if you want to do that. And that's probably the most cost-effective decision you could make. But, you know, there are a lot of other things that have to be cranked into that decision, as people who have tried working out of the house and it didn't work have found out. You know, one of the questions is, do you have a quiet, private space to work in at home? When I first started to work out of the house, just off of our entry was a study. And I thought, this is great. I will convert that study to my office and I'll work there. Well, I very quickly discovered that anybody coming over to the house during the day to see my wife or that was visiting or whatever came through the front door, looked into my study slash office, and interrupted my work. That didn't work at all. So, you know, for me, it was not going to work until we decided, well, let's take the sort of upstairs family room that we have that we weren't really using, and let's convert that to an office. And that worked perfect because it took me out of the traffic flow. It removed me. So when people came to the house, they didn't even know whether I was here or not here. They didn't interrupt me. I could talk loud. I could talk soft. I could do whatever I wanted to do. So the question is, do you have a quiet, private space to work in at home? And who's at home? You know, Leslie and I are in the situation, no children at home. So it's quiet. What if you have four children under 10 years old and they're coming and going and their friends are playing? You may not be able to get away from that. So you have to think about that. And maybe the toughest thing is, are you disciplined enough to work at home with all the great distractions that are available? You know, I sit down to work and decide, you know, it'd be nice to have an espresso. Let's pop down to the kitchen and turn on the espresso machine. And while I'm on my way down there, I realize the morning paper's here. Let's stop and read the paper. Or you know, it's worse than the water cooler. There really are a lot of distractions. And probably one of the major distractions is that there's nobody around looking to see whether you're working or not. Now, I don't care if you're a self-starter. There's a certain amount of enjoyment we all take out of competition. It is fun to run alone. I used to do some distance running. It was a lot of fun to run alone. But it was even more fun when there was somebody running along with me. Probably the last thing to consider, and maybe one of the more important things to consider in whether you're going to work out of the house or not, is this issue of energy. You know, when I'm at a low point and don't feel too energized and the house is quiet and there's nobody else here, it's real easy to not be really pushing yourself. If you're in an office and everybody in the cubicles around you is busy working and there is the hum of things happening and printers going and people on the phone, you kind of feel like you need to get going too. So, you know, this is all part of the discussion about designing the business model. And we're not talking about the product or service you're going to sell or offer. We're talking about, how are you going to operate on a daily basis? What is your business model? You know, there's sort of some small things that seem obvious but are really important. What about accounting? How are you going to do the accounting? Are you going to hire an outside accountant? Are you going to buy an accounting software program and do it yourself? And if you're going to do it yourself and you've never done it before, should you be sitting down and spending a few dollars with a professional accountant or a tax accountant and finding out, in this new world of owning your own business that you're now in and working out of the house, what are some of the things that you should be aware of that are deductible? Gee whiz, you've always bought your car, but maybe if you leased it, it would be a much better deal than buying it and making payments. Gee whiz, what percentage of the home is your office, and can you track those expenses and use them as a write-off? And it goes on and on, so you need to look at that. You've got to look at the legal and the insurance end of it. Now, you're saying, well, I'm a small business. I'm not going to do millions of dollars. I don't need anything. Well, you know, let's assume you're in California. Is there a likelihood that you could get sued for something even if you didn't do anything wrong? Yeah, highly likely. So what's your protection against that? As a coach, I can take out insurance through the ICF has a relationship, and I have liability insurance. I love my clients. I've never had a problem in 18 years of coaching with a client, but there's always the chance that somebody somewhere that I touch in my coaching relationships could be unhappy enough that there could be a suit filed. And even if I didn't do anything wrong, could I afford to defend myself? So insurance is a key thing. Okay, let's talk about advisors. This is kind of funny, because what's the right thing to do when you have a creative idea? Well, some people advocate that you not share it with anyone for fear that they will just give you all the reasons it won't work. And they also claim that once you verbalize your idea, that there is actually less urgency on your part to put it into effect, because by just talking about it, you satisfy some of that creative need to do something. Other people take the opposite point of view. They say that if you've got a creative idea, you should find a person or a group that will give you honest feedback and support and share it with them and get their insights. I have personally found the latter to be the best way to go. I have had the benefit of those groups. I have facilitated those groups for other businesses. I've served on those kinds of groups for many businesses. I'm here to tell you that if you put the right advisory group together, whether that be one person or 15 people, and you structure it so that they know that you want the honest truth, but you want them to also be positive. You want them to not be negative people. You want them not to be people who are afraid to do things different. Then you can get the best of both worlds. You can join a professional group. There's lots of CEO peer groups. There's lots of executive forums, advisory groups. There's some volunteer ones. You can put together two or three people that you know and ask them if they would serve on it. Let's take a quick commercial break, and then I'll come back. We'll wrap up shortly.
You're listening to The Coaching Perspective with Master Certified Coach Doug Gefeller. We'll be back right after a message from our sponsors.
Can we talk about your family business? You know, that thing you put your whole life's blood, sweat, and tears into? Well, what happens when you retire or try and pass that business on to your children? At Succession Strategies, we can help you find the answers. We'll guide you through the unsettling process of protecting your family legacy and successfully passing your business on to the next generation, safely and securely, ensuring that it'll both survive and thrive for generations to come. So ask yourself just one question. Can I really afford to wait? Take the first step. take our complimentary self-assessment at successionstrategies.com or call us at 714-560-9022 to set up a free consultation at your convenience. That's succession-strategies.com.
When you use the Premier Rewards Gold Card from American Express, the rewards points can keep on multiplying. Buy three with triple points on airfare. Buy two with double points on gas and groceries. And a single point for pretty much every other dollar you spend on the card. Then, start choosing from over a million rewards to redeem all those points. Apply today and the annual fee for the first year is all on us. Call 1-800-AXP-GOLD or visit AXPGold.com. The annual fee for the card is $175. See terms, conditions, and restrictions at AXPGold.com.
All right, let's head back to Doug Gefeller as he wraps up today's conversation here. You know, when you were talking about models, I thought you were talking about, you know, like attractive women here or something. I didn't know you were. I tuned in. You know, I had a whole different expectation for what I was going to hear.
You know, and that's why you're in the entertainment business and I'm in the coaching business.
How to select a model. Boy, I tuned in right away to that one. I thought I had a few ideas I was going to offer you, but no.
Okay, well, let's get back. There's a couple other key points. I don't want this to go too long, but there's a couple of key points that came up in my latest coaching conversation that I want to cover. One is, how are you going to sell? You need to think about this ahead of time. You know, there's all kinds of ways to sell if you're going to do it. You can decide that I'm going to sell online. I'm going to use social media, advertising on Facebook, wherever. You can decide I'm going to do cold calls. I'm going to buy a list of people that fit the profile I want, and I'm going to make cold calls in person, on the phone, whatever. You can decide that I'm going to put out sales literature. I'm going to take ads and place them in magazines and businesses and bus benches and whatever else. You can decide that you're going to become known so people will come to you by doing public speaking, that you're going to go speak to groups, that there's a chance that somebody that would fit your consumer profile is there and they're going to ask about your services and buy them. You might write a book. You know, there's a number of different ways sales breaks down to push or pull. You can either go to them and try to sell or push or make them aware of your product, or you can do things that makes them come to you so that you sell them when they then come in the door. You need to think about which is the way you're the most comfortable with. It isn't always which is the best way, because frankly, a person that's good in any one of those four or five methods I just outlined, a person that's really good in any one of them will do great. A person that's not good in any one of them won't do well. So you want to take a look at that. You know, the other hard thing to talk about is fees. That's the really hard issue. How much should I charge for my services? You know, should you price it at cost plus a profit or price it at what the market will bear? And, of course, nobody wants to do it at cost plus. So we're going to, you know, say, what's the market? What do people pay for coaching? What do people pay for architects, legal services? Well, you know, as a new business, you get to test market your pricing. You know, you offer it at various prices. Remember, the way in which you're going to offer it, you're not going to be stuck for life with that. Because you're not offering it to the whole world. You know, I don't care if you took out an ad in every newspaper in the world, you still wouldn't get everybody reading it. So only the few people that read it at that point, only the few people that thought about acting on it, that remembered it, and only the few that eventually contacted you, you might be stuck and then bought your service. Those people, you might be stuck with that price for a long time, forever or for a long time. So test market it. Don't go with the highest price you could possibly imagine to begin with, but don't go with the lowest either. The other thing that I like to think about doing is I am really against negotiating or giving away professional services. If I give away my services, what have I just said the value is? You know, if I go to the car dealer, is he going to give me a car? No, he doesn't give me a car. Would he let me test drive one? Yes. What are you doing to let people test drive your service so that they're sure they want it but don't talk about offering them free services. You know, I think there's a subtle but very strong emotional distinction between those two. The other thing is, don't get into negotiating with a client about your pricing. The minute you start negotiating, you're creating and you're reinforcing the idea that the value hasn't really been established for what you're offering. So if I tell you that, oh, so you want me to coach you weekly and my fee is $1,500 a month, and you go, well, I can't afford $1,500 a month. I don't come down and say, well, gee, I'd do it for $1,000. I might come down and say, well, you know, we could look at every other week instead of weekly. That would get the price down if price is an issue for you. In other words, I'm willing to recognize that the amount of money you may be willing to spend is limited, but I'm not willing to say my services could be less than what I'm telling you. You want me to come to your office? That's a different price than if we're talking on the phone. You want me to be available 24/7? That's a different price. So I have different pricing structures for different models of coaching. You need to think this out ahead of time. You don't want to be dreaming this up in front of the client that who finally convinced he wants your services, and now you're going, what's my pricing? That's the fee question. That is what you really want to think about. A couple other really quick things is licenses. You know, as a coach, do you need a certification? Well, here's the way I want you to look at it, and this would apply to any license or any certification for any business. What do you need to be in business? When I say what do you need, I mean legally what are you required to have, one, and two, what do you need so you feel comfortable and confident? When I got into coaching, I didn't legally need to get a certification from the ICF, but I only felt comfortable and confident in offering my services after I got a certification from the ICF. The other thing you want to do is you want to look at it from the customer or the client's point of view. What do they think you need? You know, if you don't think you need a certification because you've been coaching for 20 years, but every client you approach says, are you certified? You need to rethink it. You need it because the client thinks you need it. So, you know, those are some of the things you need to think about as you, I said select, but I'm really talking about as you design the best business model for you and for your business. Now, just before I sign off, I want to let you know that I've had these lists for a long time. I've been playing with them. I've never officially offered them. If you're interested in a checklist about what we're talking about today, about selecting business models, drop me an email and I will be glad to send you a checklist. That's Doug at thecoachingperspective.com. Well, that's about it. You know who we are. We've been coaching for over 18, going on 19 years here in Orange County under the banner of The Coaching Perspective, helping to create effective teams, working with executives, working with mid-level managers, even working with entry-level people. So that's who we coach. February is around the corner. February 13th is the ICF Orange County Chapter Meeting at the Wyndham Hotel. You can get more information by going on the internet there. And that's it for today. So this is Doug Gefeller signing off, and I hope you've enjoyed the show today and that the discussion has provided you with new ideas and information that you can use immediately to identify and achieve your goals.
You've been listening to the only show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, The Coaching Perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug Gefeller.